All right, here we are at 5 o'clock. Thanks for sticking around for the e-discovery session. Let's go ahead and get started because I know I'm the last thing that's standing between you guys and riding NASCAR cars, right? So thanks for sticking around. I'm EJ Bastian. I'm the lead e-discovery program manager in Microsoft's litigation group. So I work in legal. I report to our director of e-discovery. I've spent a lot of time partnering with the product teams and with MSIT and helping them understand our e-discovery concerns, what I need in order to get my job done. But at the end of this, at the end of the day, I really, you know, work in legal, work with more closely with the lawyers than anybody else, right? So this is how we're using it. We use the e-discovery features in SharePoint 2013, Exchange 2013, and Exchange Online and SharePoint Online out of the box, really, just to accomplish what we've found to be the sweet spot for e-discovery internally at Microsoft. And so I'm here today to really kind of talk you through that, and I'll show a demo of how it goes, how easy it is to really spin up a case, add your sources, run your searches, get the intelligence that you need to make sure the outside counsel is armed for their meet and confers, make sure you're achieving a good and defensible and yet still effective cull of the data, and then getting the data offline. You can do all that really in just a matter of minutes if you know what you're looking for and how to do it. A lot of it may not be all that exciting to you because it is out of the box. Maybe it's old news, maybe you've seen this, you know, SharePoint 2013 was launched a year ago, Exchange Online, or Exchange 2013 was launched a year ago. But it's really exciting for us because we're able to do what we used to have to spend weeks or months on in a matter of minutes or hours nowadays. But just to level set, let's talk about e-discovery first. I can really summarize our e-discovery concerns in one of two main points, at least according to the law, right? We have a duty to preserve the potentially relevant data. When we're sued, opposing counsel can propound discovery requests asking us to hand over documents that will help them supposedly prove their allegations against us. Or on the more positive side, it'll help us get out of trouble, right? It'll exonerate us, right? But either way, we're legally obligated to do that. We need to protect the content so that it doesn't get deleted, whether it's through an act of negligence or through an act of, you know, intentional spoliation. We, as an e-discovery department and Microsoft's litigation group, need to prevent that from actually happening. It's far worse to be accused of purging content than it is to have bad data show up at trial, right? Because if you intentionally expunge data that should be subject to legal hold, you can have dire consequences, right? Your whole defense could be thrown out, and the judge could instruct the jury that, with an adverse inference to assume that the documents that we didn't produce proved opposing counsel's case against us, right? So it's not just a matter of money. It's not just a fine at the end of the day. I mean, you could lose your whole case just by being a bad litigant, by not fulfilling your discovery obligations. So our concern, being the e-discovery managers at Microsoft, is not just preventing the deletion of that data, but also minimizing the impact to our business, right? And we want to minimize costs, we want to make it easy and seamless, and be out of the way of the business, right? The most important thing for our company is being a productive company. It's not being the world's best litigant. Litigation is the tail that can't wag the dog, right? So we've worked with the product team to make sure that we can fulfill our obligations without really impacting or burdening the rest of the company that needs to be out there being productive, managing their data the way that they need to for the purposes of our business, and we've got our compliance concerns taken care of behind the scenes. And then next, we have to be able to find the relevant data that we need to produce to opposing parties, right? When they do propound their discovery requests, they say, give us all your documents that relate to these topics, we have to be able to quickly and easily go out and find those documents to be able to hand it off in an efficient manner, right? There's really aggressive deadlines set by the courts that we have to abide by. And again, there's, you know, dangers and perils if we miss those deadlines, if we can't find the data that we need to produce the other side. But e-discovery has long since been as much art as it has been science. There's no one right way of doing it. There's a lot of different tools that help manage each different stage of the e-discovery process. And Heretofore, it's really been described as a linear process, where first you have to collect the data in order to preserve it, and then you have to take what you've collected and process it to be able to search it. And then once you can search it, you can find what you actually want to get your attorneys to review. And then they use any number of different tools to do those first stages, and then any number of separate tools to manage the review components, where the attorneys can go through and make their page-by-page decisions on the document. This one's responsive, that one's non-responsive, this one's privileged, that one's highly confidential, right? Where they do their redactions. And then it goes to, once they've defined their production set, it goes into yet another tool to get it into a producible format, right? Near natives, TIFF files, where people are basically creating an electronic version of a printed page where you can hand something off to outside counsel that they can see on a computer but not really interact with and modify from its native file format. So I've color-coded what's been kind of boiled down as the EDRM process here, so that you can kind of see what we do in-house versus what we've found to be more effective to outsource. And these are the stages that, the light blue stages are the ones that you can really kind of easily out of the box manage using Office 2013 and Office Online, Exchange Online, SharePoint Online, Office 365, right, there it is. To manage for you out of the box, right? We've got the ability to identify and preserve the content, and we've got the ability to protect it in place, so you don't have to be working with a preservation copy so much anymore. And the data now lives in a processed state already, so you don't have to re-index the content just to be able to go in and find what your attorneys actually need. So you can do your searches, you can do your data minimization in place, and just download all in one fell swoop all the content that you actually want to pay your attorneys to go through page by page and actually incur per gigabyte charges on at that level, right? But because there are so many different review tools out there and so many different, litigation support vendors and the review component is not just focused on how to most efficiently get from a huge mountain of data to just the items that have to be produced, you also need to use that review to educate the attorneys who are defending you. They need to be able to gain intelligence based on their familiarity with the documents they're going to produce, right? So you want them to be able to use whatever tool for review that's best going to help them amplify their attorney skills, right? How can they most effectively get through the data? So we like letting our attorneys decide what the best tool is, where they're going to actually manage the subset of data that they actually need. We don't want to give them more than they need in that tool. We want to protect it behind the firewall and only hand them off that small subset they actually think is potentially relevant. And then it goes to a litigation support vendor for the production side of it. We just don't have the FTEs or the internal infrastructure to be able to manage all those workflows. So if we look at our docket, you see why this really starts to matter for us. Now, Microsoft's got about 400 active cases, active legal holds right now. But over the last 3 years, our averages have been 68 cases per year with active e-discovery efforts, right? 68 cases that come in where we actually need to do some processing, searching, preservation work to get to be able to fulfill our legal obligations. And across those averages for the last 3 years, the average cases look like this, right? 45 people are typically under a legal hold at Microsoft for a given case. The average Microsoftie has just over 30 gigabytes of searchable content. And so by searchable, I mean content that's likely to be a discoverable document. I'm excluding system files. I'm excluding media files, their pictures, their music libraries, et cetera, and really just focusing in on the data that I would search if I had to find the potentially relevant content that I want to get to my attorneys, right? So 30 gigs each, 45 people. So we're talking about 1.3 terabytes of data that's being preserved for each case. Back in the day when we used to have to collect everything in order to preserve it, it'd be really painful if we had to go out to 45 people and get 30 gigabytes per person, store an offline copy while they still have their working copy for themselves, right, that they use for business purposes. It's a huge duplication of data that really shouldn't be happening. And then as we get to know the case and we get the RFPs and we determine or we get a better understanding of what opposing counsel's allegations are, what they're really after with regard to our documents, we average out to 13 people whose data needs to be processed and searched for the case with really sophisticated search terms, right? And so the average for the cases that we've processed over the last 3 years have been about just shy of 300 gigabytes of content being searched and processed per case. After we have processed that data and found what the attorneys actually want to review, it's only been a subset of just shy of 17 gigs per case that they actually need to do the page-by-page reviews on, right? So 95% of our custodians' data completely has no relevance to the issues of the lawsuit itself, right? And so it's kind of, you're always dealing with this inverted pyramid shape where you've just got a ton of data at the top and you can kind of go through and cull away and find the really relevant data. And even though we're reviewing only 5% of our custodians' raw content, you see what actually gets produced on average is just 4 gigabytes. So just shy of 25% of what gets reviewed is actually discoverable and producible, according to our attorneys, right? And then adding insult to injury, it's not just those 4 gigabytes that are actually relevant to the case. It's only statistically 1 out of 1,000 documents that get produced ever see the light of day in litigation, get presented to the court, or get used as an exhibit at trial or in deposition. So we're talking about all this effort for just about 250 actual pages of content. Now, if we had done what we used to do, right, and just collect the custodian's data and hand it, just completely outsource it from there, we'd be incurring per gigabyte charges. The first thing that that the litigation support vendor who would receive the data from us would be to process, right, index, extract the text, and be able to run searches to define what the attorneys actually want to review. They charge us per gigabyte to do that, right? It's per gigabyte per hour for the time they spend doing it. But if it's just a rack rate of $200 per gig, which seems to be kind of the industry standard right now for what they'd process, we'd be incurring $58,000 of data processing charges per case, right? And with 68 active cases per year, we're talking $3.9 million to be able to process, search, and find what subset of that data needs to be reviewed. Not only is that wasteful from a cost perspective, but from a security perspective, it's horrible to think that we're taking the entirety of our custodian's data, right, that probably has nothing to do with this case, and throwing that over the protection of our firewall, right? Lawyers have historically done this because, you know, people don't question their lawyers. They just say, well, if we're legally obligated to do this, then to hell with the security. I think a lot of security officers are probably just absent in those decisions, but it's pretty scary when you're thinking about it, right? I mean, yeah, you trust these vendors, and yeah, they're going to your lawyers, but do you trust them more than you trust your own FTEs and your own security organization that's protecting the content in place? I mean, it's a lot of waste, not just perspective, but also from it just is too open to risk. So when we brought the ability to do the processing and searching in-house, and we've been able to cull away 95% of our custodians' raw data, it reduces our charges just from a data processing perspective from $58,000 to just about $3,000 per case. And with 68 cases per year, we're talking about a savings right off the top of $3.7 million per year, right? So immense savings, right, using technology that's, you know, just part of what we've got in our native office offering. We were doing this before we had the ability to do it with Office. When the economy fell apart in 2008, we were charged by our general counsel to reduce our litigation budget by millions of dollars per year. And one of the ways we went about doing that was bringing the e-discovery processing in-house, right? Gartner published a report saying if you go and you license an off-the-shelf tool, you start doing this internally instead of paying per use per gig to some vendor, you're going to see an ROI in 3 to 9 months. Well, we did that. We went and licensed an off-the-shelf tool and got internal FTEs trained on using that and saw an ROI in just under 3 months, and it was wonderful. But it was a difficult process. It was a small team of e-discovery professionals who were really burning the candle at both ends. right? I mean, I remember the last 3 summers an issue would arise, and it would lead me to a stage of work where I'd be spending 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for 8 weeks in a row on average for each of the last summers, just to be able to get the data to our attorneys, right? It just became this constant barrage of work, but we were saving a ton of money, so it was all, at the end of it was all worth it. And the process really looked like this, right? We'd work with our custodians to identify all the various locations where the custodians are maintaining their potentially relevant data, and send a paralegal out to all those sources, and they'd go collect it and bring back a copy of it, right? So they'd go and export all the content from the custodians' mailboxes. They would image their hard drive. They would really have a hard time trying to collect all the content from the SharePoint sites, because in the pre-2013 SharePoint sites, there's no easy collection method whatsoever, right? So they'd be taking single web page archive, save as. They'd navigate to a page, do a save as, bring the file down, move on to the next page. Or they'd be, going into Explorer view and trying to copy out a bunch of documents that way, but it's risky. You could be altering metadata in doing that. You could be missing a bunch of content. They'd take copies of content from wherever our custodians were maintaining it, right? There's also file shares and anywhere else. And they'd take a copy of all that and they'd bring it back to a litigation data repository that we had sitting at a third-party data center. And it was really just a series of Windows file shares there. And we organized the collections by custodian, by collection. We'd keep all the folder structure and metadata of the files intact there. But it's completely duplicated of what's actually in our network, right? What our custodians are actually interacting with on a data basis. But we've got our preservation copy there. And when it comes time to search that stuff, I take a working copy of the preservation copy. So by this point, I'm on my 3rd copy of the data. Load it into this data minimization tool, try to start processing it, right? Indexing the data, remediating the files that couldn't be indexed out of the box, whether it's because it was a PST that was just too large and the tool couldn't handle it, or if there was some sort of corruption there, because when you're moving a huge PST from one disk to another, it's really common that it happens. So I spend hours and hours running scan PST, getting the data into a searchable state, processing it, but it's sitting outside of our firewall, so it's not it doesn't have their necessary certificates to allow me to look past and index past encryption, so I'd then have to run searches of the data to find what wasn't fully indexed because it was encrypted, and then download that, decrypt it, re-upload it, re-index it, and it becomes this feedback loop of endless work before I can actually go and feel like I'm getting a representative when I run my search terms that the attorneys want me to run, that I'd be getting, the actually accurate results, that I've got everything that our custodians have represented by what I'm downloading. And so from day one, when my attorneys are really anxious to start seeing the data, it kicks off this long process before I can actually do what they need. They say on day one, go get these 13 custodians' data, run these keywords against it, and give me the hits. I want to start reviewing it. They, by the time they know that they need that, they are the clock's already ticking. So then it starts off this process that takes 2 to 3 weeks, and it's really frustrating to them that they are losing all this time. They don't, they don't have access to the data, but again, we're saving money, so it's fine. It's worth it for us. At the end of the day, at the end of the process, I'm able to actually get the data out eventually from the data minimization tool, and I hand that off to that lit support vendor, and they batch it into review batches in a linear review tool like KQRS Relativity. And then they put it out in front of the review attorneys. They make their decisions, figure out what needs to be produced, work with the lit support vendor, and all that was outsourced, right? From the moment that I'm handing off the data, the FTEs at Microsoft are pretty much done dealing with the data. So it's an ugly process, but it was helpful for us. We saved millions in doing it, but fortunately I had the interest of the product teams in Exchange and in SharePoint and Link and Windows Server, who were sitting there saying, well, what can we do to make this easier for you? How can we make it so that you're able to do the same cost saving activities without having to use off-the-shelf or third-party technology? without having to take content out of all these repositories, the native repositories, and bring them somewhere else to do this work, right? So they worked at trying to address the need to export content in bulk from Exchange and from SharePoint, and tried to build out the ability to preserve content in place instead of forcing us to keep content in this offline data repository for preservation purposes. And extending that, how could they bring in the search functionality, replicating the really important features that I needed from my data minimization tool, which was capable of doing far more than we ever used it to, right? To save the millions that we were doing, just a search tool, even though it was capable of a lot more, we were just using it to process and run searches, right? So we said, we need the ability to, we need a more robust query syntax for the eDiscovery features in Exchange and in SharePoint. We're always using proximity, we're always using, you know, nested, very sophisticated queries. So they built that out, and with the deployment of Office 2013, our process has really started looking a lot, it's really turned into this. I can go into SharePoint, create an eDiscovery case in SharePoint Online or in SharePoint 2013 on-prem. Microsoft's in a hybrid environment, so I've got an eDiscovery center in both those locations. And I can add my sources to it, whether they're other SharePoint sites or Exchange 2013 mailboxes, the searches also encompass the link 2013 data that's in those Exchange mailboxes. On-prem, we've also got SharePoint 2013 configured to index a bunch of litigation-managed file shares. So our old offline litigation data repository we brought behind the firewall, and it's just sitting on file shares that are managed by the litigation group at Microsoft and indexed by SharePoint. So any content that's not natively searchable in SharePoint or Exchange, we still send paralegals out in the image hard drives and bring the non-PST content on those hard drives and put them back on those file shares and take the PST content that's sitting on those desktops and we import them back into Exchange mailboxes so that we can use SharePoint's eDiscovery Center to run our searches, apply in-place preservation, so that content's protected while our end users are still able to collaborate on documents, manage their mail however they want, even delete it, and it's protected behind the scenes without requiring a duplicate copy. I can go in and I can run my searches, tell the attorneys what they'd be getting if this is what they're asking us to search, if this is what they're saying they want to review. Within minutes, I can tell them what they'd be getting, and then within a couple hours after they say go, I can download all the content in one action, hand it off to the same litigation support vendor who's been managing the offline processes for us for years, right? It goes in the same linear review tool, gets batched out in front of before the same review attorneys. Nothing is different for what's happening down channel, right? After we pass the data outside of our organization, it's still the same data we've always gotten. It only took hours to get to this time instead of, 2 to 3 weeks. So there is the issue of managing the offline content, and this is the only thing that we're doing that's not out of box at Microsoft. We had to come up with a supplementary process to kind of catalog and stay in front of the data that we've got sitting on those file shares. The data that's offline still needs to be collected before it can be searched. And so our solution was just a series of Windows Server file shares, a SQL database, and a custom web UI catalogs and organizes that content. So our paralegals go out and they collect the content from the local desktops or whatever else is not available or searchable in place. And they bring it back and they drop it on a file share. And they check the collection into this, this web UI that we've gotten. They just create the custodian if the custodian entry is not already there, or if the custodian's there, they just go in and update and add a new collection. And then it kicks off a process that merges the newly collected content with the previously collected content that we have for those custodians, right? And it's sitting on a single file share. The system generates some import scripts for us. If it detects that there are PSTs, it will automatically generate PowerShell scripts that are going to enable us to run new mailbox import request that's going to port the PSTs back into Exchange mailboxes. And then when it comes time to search a given custodian's data, all I do is go and consult this database to figure out where the custodian's data actually is. So I've got a couple screenshots here so you can see essentially what it looks like. If I need to search Steve Ballmer's data, I go look him up in the tool, and it shows me where his data is, right? It's sitting, his offline files are sitting on this file share, right? It just gives me the UNC, the server share, and then the folder that contains his data. And then he's also got data in several Exchange mailboxes, right? There's the SteveB@Microsoft.com that, you know, he uses on a day-to-day basis. But we've also got some litigation archive mailboxes that are designed to hold the PST content that we've collected from over the years. And so I know that when I need to search Steve's data, I have to search the content that's sitting at this path and then add all three of these mailboxes at sources in my eDiscovery set in the SharePoint eDiscovery Center so that I can search all of his data and give my attorneys comprehensive results. And the way that it looks on the file share, right, what's sitting at this path, you know, it's just a bunch of numbered folders that contain all the data that we've gotten from him at different times. So he's been collected from numerous times over the years, as you can imagine. And so we've got it all organized there. So we're searching the entirety of his data. But that's it. Aside from that, everything else is out of box. So I just wanted to show you a quick demo of the eDiscovery Center. We'll create a case, and we'll run some searches and do an export. I can show you, you know, how we're thinking about it in the litigation group at Microsoft. So our primary interface for this is the SharePoint eDiscovery Center. It looks the same online and on-prem. Our demo environment is out here at on SharePoint online. But the look and feel, the functionality is the same. And it's just a site collection that's consuming from our central search farm. And I would go and create a new SharePoint site for each case and organize all my preservation and search and export efforts under that single case site. So we'll just create a new site, and it's, you know, you're seconds away from being able to do what you actually need to from an eDiscovery perspective. So you give, like creating any other SharePoint site, it's just give it a name, give it a URL, choose, you know, set your permissions, and you're really off and running. All right, so we'll just call this the SPC14 eDiscovery Center demo. Give it the URL. You can choose what language you want it to render in. It's going to pre-select the eDiscovery case template that's going to bring in the necessary web parts that are going to allow you to do your eDiscovery work on the case. You can assign unique permissions to make it so that only certain attorneys or certain paralegals have access to this particular site, or you could do it the way we do it at Microsoft, which is limit the ability to even get to the eDiscovery Center to the people who should be empowered to actually manage the cases and give them all access. So we typically are using the same permissions of the parent site. And lastly, it asked about navigational inheritance. Do you want a link to the new page from the eDiscovery Center site collection homepage, or do you want, and then do you want to link back to it, or do you want to just remember how to get to it with the URLs, which is typically what we're doing, because with, you know, almost 400 active cases, you can imagine it's a pretty long list of individual case sites that we've got. So here at the homepage of our case site here, our work is really kind of organized in one of two buckets, right? First, we've got the identification and hold section where we bring in the sources that we care about and apply preservation to them. And then we can do more granular searches and exports down here. So first things first, let's create an eDiscovery set and do a quick investigation of our sales team. So an eDiscovery set is basically a group of sources that you want to handle as an atomic unit from a preservation perspective. So it'll make more sense as we go along, but let's just say we're creating this for our sales team, and we want to add the sources that our sales team uses to manage their data. So we'll add the mailboxes belonging to the folks that work on the sales team, right? And I can add them by their alias or by their display name. And I click this icon over here to validate against Active Directory and I get the green check mark indicating that it really will allow me to search this and preserve this. It's not going to fail on me in the blind. If for whatever reason I don't have the necessary permissions, it's going to give me a big red error, making it crystal clear that I'm not going to accomplish what I need to accomplish when I do this. And so from an e-discovery perspective, that's important to us because we need to be aware of the boundaries of what we're able to do. We need to know what we're blind to. We need to know if things are going wrong in order to make sure that our process is really defensible. But I may not know exactly everybody whose mailbox that I want to bring in, so I can run searches against Exchange to find the mailboxes that I'm looking for. Or I can also use this to add mailboxes in bulk by entering just a distribution list, right? So I found my sales team distribution list, and it has multiple mailboxes subscribed to it. I can add just the DL, and it'll bring in all the individual mailboxes that are on it today. But I can use this to add up to 1,500 mailbox sources to my case. And with the average case at Microsoft being 45, that's overkill. You have a question? Right. Yeah. Right now, there's not that ability. We can't populate it with a CSV and bring in all these sources. So that's something that I've heard some people ask for. It's something that might make it a little easier for us. But really, at Microsoft, it's kind of rare that we know the full list on day one. So I'm usually not in here with a huge list of 45 mailboxes all at once. You know, on day one, when Legal Hold goes out to the first people who are the most germane to the case, the most relevant, then, you know, I might be adding 5 or 10 on day one. And then the next day I add, you know, part of our Legal Hold notice is the instructions go out to people and they say, tell us who else might have these documents, right? And so it's an iterative process, and these are kind of building dynamic, you know, over the next several days. So it's really not that bad for us, but that would be kind of a nice thing to have. And I know that Quentin's sitting right in front of you thinking, how can I build this for the future? So I add my mailboxes, and I'll add the locations, and I'll just copy a couple of URLs of site collections. So this is the sales and marketing site collection, and I validate that source using a similar icon, right? And it resolves from the URL to the friendly name of the site collection, confirming for me that I really do have permission to really to be able to reach that, and it's not just, I'm not moving forward kind of assuming that everything's working. I actually have some validation there. So what I really like about this is that I'm adding the top level of a site collection, and I'm getting everything underneath it. I don't have to add all the individual sub-sites of a SharePoint site. I don't have to add the individual blogs or wikis or pages or document libraries, right? I just go and add the sales and marketing site, and everything at that level and below it is added automatically. So I'll add one more for good measure. And when I'm on-prem, you know, if I have an index file share that I want to add, I could just copy in a UNC path, right? So server, share, folder, right? And everything that's in this folder and below it would also be added as a searchable source. Now, we can protect content in place if it's in Exchange 2013 or if it's in a SharePoint 2013 site collection. But we can also search, even though I can't protect in place, but I can search the content in file shares as well. So we've, you know, managed business process to protect the content that's sitting on our file shares by putting that content into a litigation managed file share where there's limited access. The data is not going to disappear on us through, you know, day-to-day interactions with it. And that's where we manage the legal holds for our offline content. But I don't have anything in my demo environment that's in a file share, so let's just go ahead with these sources. I hit OK, and it's going to bring me back out to the eDiscovery Set page, and it's going to do a quick search, expanding the sources, telling me how much content is in each source. It's going to expand the membership of that DL and bring in the individual users. So back here in the background, you can see Garth Fort, Sarah Davis, Katie Jordan. You saw me enter those names specifically, but then there's names like Robin Counts, Alex Darrow. They were just part of that DL, so it's a great way of bringing in a bunch of names just, you know, in one step. So it tells me there are 78 items weighing in at 3.5 megs in Garth's mailbox, and 680 items weighing in at 94.67 megs in the sales and marketing SharePoint site, including all of its subsites. And we've got a total of just about 1,300 items weighing in at 151 megabytes in those sources today. Typically at Microsoft, when we are issuing legal holds, it's at a time where we don't know enough about the case to limit what we're going to preserve in place. And so we'll typically just add the sources that we know about, hit enable in place hold, and then hit save, and apply preservation in place to everything in those sources, right? Everything in Garth's mailbox that's there today, all 78 items, and anything that's added in the future until I come back and amend this e-discovery set are going to be protected regardless of whether Garth wants to abide by the instructions he's gotten or not from a legal hold perspective, right? Anything that he purges will still be protected in place and stay indexed and discoverable without any additional action. And the same goes for the SharePoint 2013 site collection contents, right? The end users can continue collaborating on documents, create new ones, modify existing documents, even delete them, and we've still got everything protected in place without affecting the actual end users. But, as you do get to know the case, you don't have to save everything. You need to just save the content that's potentially relevant. So you might come back and after a while you realize that the issues germane to the case really were centralized in a certain date range, and you can limit what you're holding in place by using a start and or end date, or they're just interactions with a certain company, so you could say, well, I only want to keep the content that came from, at contoso.com addresses, or you can filter based on keywords as well. And, typically for preservation purposes, we're not getting very sophisticated with our keyword queries. We use very sophisticated queries for the query and export section, but we tend to hold quite broadly, so I might, For this case, I might just say, well, we need to hold everything that relates to the company's Northwind or Wingtip. And just run that search. I just hit get statistics, and it finds the subset of my 1,300 items that actually meet the query criteria. If I wanted to make that very sophisticated, I could. But we tend to hold broadly at Microsoft anyway. So it just ran a quick search, and it found 113 of my 1,300 items that are relevant according to the keywords that my attorneys have told me they want to use for preservation. Yes?
On the keyword search, if you have a PDF, which is the information
that
correlates, a tip or an FN, the keyword search would exclude it from
this. So, yeah. That's a great point, right? So there could be uncrawlable content, items that weren't fully indexed sitting in our sources that would be relevant and would be responsive to the keyword queries according to the terms that we're using, but for the fact that the indexer didn't OCR, it doesn't know that they actually do contain those words. The in-place preservation is smart enough to allow only content that's fully indexed and has no index errors to be expunged. The content that has been marked as having an index error will also be proactively held in place. So we're going to be protecting in place the content that's known to be responsive according to the query that we've got here, or the items that aren't fully searchable and we're not confident whether or not they should be eligible. We're not confident they don't meet the query criteria. So we've got a belt and suspenders approach to that to make sure that otherwise we wouldn't be using it. Yeah, another question? So the question is the history of this tracked and auditable? If on day one we're using one query against one set of sources, and then later on we expand it or narrow it or add different sources or apply different keywords, yes, it's tracked. You have to make sure you're configuring auditing to track those actions first. But once it's there, you've got that. You're covered.
Question. So we use a lot of RMS protection on our documents, and we've been told by other vendors in the
So RMS is a great example. When RMS is applied at the source, our indexer can read past it, right? So if the encryption is applied at the server in the mailbox, right? And if somebody creates a mail item and they say protect this and it's encrypted with RMS, indexers already indexed that. I'm empowered as the eDiscovery administrator to search the entirety of the index, right? So I can see past the encryption. When I go to download the item, it'll find it as a search hit, but it'll export it out with the RMS encryption. So when I've got my offline copy, I'll need to make sure that I pass it through a bulk decryption tool before handing it off to my attorneys to make sure that they have the same level of access to it outside of a firewall that I do inside the firewall. But fortunately, we can actually read RMS encrypted content. Now there are certain types of encryption that we can't see around, and those are just tagged as index errors and would be protected in place because of that flag, right?
So when you're talking about the indexing that's going on this to make the searching working, is that using that's not record center that allows that search? I mean, what turns on the indexing to
so that Yeah, so all data in exchange is indexed. And it's the same indexing technology in exchange as in SharePoint, right? So it's fast in both, so you're getting consistent search results against both. So all the data in SharePoint is being indexed according to the our search administrators, and then all the data in exchange is indexed out of the box. That's how it works. Another question? Nope. This is actually protecting it in place, right? So the way it works is, let's talk about Garth's mailbox there, right? If I enable in place hold, it's not going to take a copy of the content that's there. It's if Garth goes to delete something from his inbox, it goes to his deleted items folder, right? And he can still access it. And he goes into his deleted items folder and he wants to delete it from there. And it goes out of the primary mailbox and into the recoverable items partition of the mailbox. And it's sitting in recoverable items / deletions. It's sitting in a subfolder there that Garth may have limited access to. If you make it possible for your end users to recover deleted items, they might be able to see what's at that top level of the recoverable items partition to if they're a good actor, to just be able to bring it back into their mailbox if they inadvertently deleted something that they need for business purposes. But if they're going in there trying to purge the content that they can see in the recoverable items partition, it's just going to push it deeper into that recoverable items partition. It'll go into a purges subfolder that they have no access to. So it's going to be protected there, right? So Garth's thinking he's purged it completely from his mailbox. It actually frees up his mailbox quota and is sitting in a different quota in the recoverable items partition. But only then are we keeping content that Garth doesn't want, right? Aside from that, I'm searching the content in his live mailbox and the content if he's been, if his mailbox has in place hold enabled on it, the content that he's purged from his, what he can see of his mailbox, it's only protecting the content that he's gotten rid of, right? It only acts when he tries to get rid of something. So right now, what we're looking at is what's in those mailboxes right now, right? And I've done a filtered preservation set, right? Where I said I only want to protect the content that says Northwind or Wingtip here, right? And so I ran that search, and it found the 113 items that say Northwind or Wingtip today, and it's going to protect those. But when I hit save, I check enable in place hold and hit save, and I close this, And then 3 months go by, and I don't do any additional activity, but Garth's still getting new mail day in, day out, right? And right. Maybe some of that content comes in saying north wind or wingtip. These are forward-looking holds, right? It's going to find anything that gets added to the mailbox that says north wind or wingtip, and it's going to protect that content as well. These are dynamic and looking forward, so it's not like it's not limited with what I'm doing today, and I don't have to come back and refresh this myself just to make sure that I'm protecting everything in place.
So it finds the modified content as well.
Yes, newly added content. Right now, it's looking at right now. So these numbers here reflect what's in the mailbox in its entirety. Right, and a mailbox has two primary partitions. There's what the end user can see, the inbox, the deleted items, the sent items, et cetera. And then there's the part that the end user can't really see, the recoverable items partition. But it's searching whatever's there today, right? So out-of-box data lives in the recoverable items partition for 14 days, according to the single item recovery limit, after the person has fully purged it from, you know, what they need, right? They've deleted it from deleted items, and it goes into recoverable items. If they're not on hold, it'll be held for 14 days and deleted at the end of that 14th day. But if their mailbox has been enabled for hold on any other case, we'd be searching the entirety of what's in that repository that's there right now, and then it'll protect the content that's added until I come back and lift this hold. So before I move on, I just want to point out that I can preview these results, right? So I don't have to just trust the veracity of these filters in the blind. I can go through and do a quick quality check and see a read-only rendering of these items and do a quick glance through to see if maybe there are terms that I want to add and build in a not clause to my query, right? If it's holding content that I think should be relevant, I can click in, read it, you know, and say, okay, here's the latest copy of the proposal. Let me know if you have any question. I don't, you know, there's not much substance there, but if you can imagine, right, finding something that's hitting on a keyword that you've used that's really irrelevant, right? Maybe what I care about is the marketing efforts and I don't care about the, you know, the acquisition efforts or something, and I can come back and modify my query to include a not clause to try to exclude that content that's adding false positives to my search results. You'll notice I don't have any action buttons here. I can't forward it, I can't reply to it, I can't modify it, I can't edit it, I can't save it locally. It's just a quick glance to help me feel good about the results of my query, right? And so the Exchange content is on that tab, the SharePoint content is on that tab. Can't take individual activities on the individual items listed there, but at least it gives me a quick view into the data that I'm dealing with. So I'll go ahead and hit save on this eDiscovery set, and it's going to protect the content that's there in those seven sources, all 113 items that are there today, and whatever would get added that would meet the criteria in the future. Back here at my homepage, I see there are seven sources that are processing for in-place hold. Soon they'll, you know, graduate to seven sources that are actually on hold with filter. But these are hyperlinked numbers, right? And so if it says there are five that are on hold with filter and two failed, well, I could just click the two and see what two sources in particular failed and why, so that I could go back and, you know, talk with my IT team, say, these failed, here's the error code, we need to make sure that this is resolved so I can protect content consistently across all the sources that I care about for this case. And so that's applying preservation in place, but there's even more robust query functionality when it comes to not just applying legal hold, but finding what you actually want to pay your attorneys to review, right? Because it's probably a smaller subset of what you need to preserve that you actually want to pay somebody to review, right? You protect broadly, you review narrowly, and you can expand your review set if you need to out of what's been preserved later on down the line, but in trying to control costs, you want to limit what you're spending, you know, attorney fees on. So we'll give this query a name so we can distinguish it from any other queries that we might run over the life of this case. This will be our sales investigation. And I'm just going to copy and paste a search term that outside counsel has asked me to run against these sources. I'll just copy and paste it in there. I can use date restrictions or author sender restrictions. It's going to assume that I want to search the sources that I brought in, but not just the sources in their entirety, right? It assumes that if I care enough to limit my scope for what's being preserved, that I also want to limit my searches to just what's been preserved there, right? So the first thing it did when it opened this query was run the eDiscovery set query, right? And it found the same 113 items that we already knew about, because no time has really transpired, right, since we applied preservation. But you can imagine if months went by, you'd be seeing a lot more data here when it runs that query. And it tells me, you know, how much content is coming from each individual source. And if I want, I can modify the query scope so that I could actually search more broadly than what I'm preserving, right? I could have my new query focused on a single eDiscovery set if there were multiple eDiscovery sets. Or I can break apart the eDiscovery sets and clear the filters and just choose Katie's mailbox and Robin's mailbox and the finance site. Or I can even add new mailboxes or new locations from here if I want. But just logically, it makes sense for us to scope what we care about for the case and then to further refine what we want to get to our attorneys using queries. So it's basically anding the new query to the existing eDiscovery set query. So I'm just going to run the query on the spot, and it's going to go look for all the documents that say Northwind within 30 non-matching words in either direction of SalesStar, or MarkStar, MKTG, or CompStar, or anything that says Wingtip. And it finished, right? It found the 38 items of my 113 really quickly, you know, within seconds. And you know, you're thinking, well, of course it happened quickly. You're dealing with, you know, just a few megabytes of content. But we're seeing the same types of performance in production where we're dealing with really terabytes of data in place. We can search across massive data stores and get, you know, quick results. And, you know, honestly, when I'm dealing with outside counsel, I often have a screen sharing session, right? We'll just do a link session and I'll show them my desktop remotely and they'll say, this is what I'm looking for, and we'll just go and do the searches live and, you know, iterate on these, right, right on the spot. So, you know, it found 38 items. That's really nothing, but usually outside counsel is saying, well, I don't know, maybe go find Xbox within 20 words of 360. You can imagine we've got quite a few documents like that. You know, and they tend to give us, you know, very complex queries that yield very broad result sets. And so they're often, you know, kind of befuddled. Well, can you tell me what particular subcombination of the term is really driving the volume there? And that used to drive me nuts when they'd ask me to do that when I was using an offline tool, because I'd have to recompile the complex query and rerun it manually as, you know, Northwind within 30 words of SalesStar, or Northwind within 30 words of MarkStar, or Northwind within 30 words of CompStar. But with this, right, I can just hit this plus icon and expand the query statistics section, and it's gonna start reporting on what's being returned by the subcombinations of that term, right? It follows the query logic and shows me what's actually there, so I can just, you know, before I can even explain the feature to them, they can see that, well, there are 15 items being returned by CompStar, and there's 24 being returned by MarkStar. And maybe 24 of my 38 is too many, and maybe I'm getting too many variants of Mark that is mishits on Marks or Marked, and I really just care about variants of marketing. So I can just change my query on the fly, rerun search, seconds later see if I have a better call, right? It's found the same 38 items, so at least I have the confirmation that these really are on point from a subject perspective. And so maybe there's other types of filtering that I can do, right? The attorney might say, well, really what I just care about is what this person said to that person. And so let's limit the exchange results to just communications, right? Whether they're emails or the link content there, right? The IMs. But we don't care about contacts or meetings or tasks. And so I can apply this filter and see if my 13 exchange results that are the subset that are of these 38 that are actually coming from exchange, there are actually only 7 that are, you know, email or IM communications. Then I can even further iterate on that and say, well, let's make it so that Garth has to be a participant, meaning he's either the sender or on one of the recipient lines, whether that's 2CC or BCC. Or, you know, Katie has to be the recipient and Sarah has to be the sender, and the subject line has to say Northwind acquisition timeline, right? I can use these really effectively to build more and more sophisticated queries and save them so that I can come back to them in the future and rerun them, because data lives in an index state. Next time I navigate to this, it'll rerun the search and find all the new content that has accrued since the last time I ran this. Did you have a question? Right. So right now, that's actually something that the engineering team has been focusing on, trying to deliver a better, even stronger functionality around how to handle distribution lists. Right now, you can look for the email address that it was sent to. And so if we're talking sales@contoso.com, you could find the items that were just sent to that entire DL. But only when it's sent to that DL, not to a recipient on that DL, right? So it's not tying in, and it's not looking more deeply than that. It's going to be whatever I type in there. So typically, I would be using this only if I care about particular participants, if I'm really trying to drive deep into what happened from an investigation standpoint. Usually, I don't have to go that deep because we're trying to find, the molehill of relevant data that's still going to be kind of large, right? The 17 gigs of content that we want to pay our attorneys to review instead of the 300 gigs of content, but it's still going to be a lot of content that I do need to get to them. Is there another question? Yeah. So the way we have it at Microsoft is my account has this permission. So the question is, from a security perspective, how do we permission these accounts? Does it have to be, do you have to give somebody carte blanche access to be able to see this content, or can you assign it to an elevated access account that would have, more permissions than the average user? The flexibility is there. Now, I can search this from an eDiscovery administrator perspective. I can get a read-only glance into the Exchange content, but I can't access the Exchange mailboxes themselves. I can't open them through Outlook. I can't send mail as that person. I can't go in there and delete content. I can't reply to their content. I can only get an eDiscovery read of it, right, which allows me to quickly read it and export it. Yes, did you have another question?
Yes, how does that work out for minor and major versions of the script part? If I set up my libraries that are only people that can contribute to the library, can see the content that is contributed, how does that apply to the permissions that you have to have in order to run and execute that query?
Right, so the question really boils down to how does SharePoint have to be permissioned? Can you just have a read-only access? So there's an eDiscovery administrator role, and you want to make sure that your SharePoint, that eDiscovery, the members of that eDiscovery role group have read-only permissions to what they're going to need to be able to search, right? What they can see and find from SharePoint sites through this tool, through this interface, is going to be governed by their permission, right? Because this is just searching the existing SharePoint index, and what they can see is going to be limited to what they've been permissioned for. So at Microsoft, we had to make it so that our eDiscovery administrators have read-only permission to everything and access to the crawl logs so that we can find the index errors as well. Another question? That's right to a certain extent. Now you can see that if you're searching the question was, is BCC data searchable and discoverable in Exchange sources? And the answer is yes, when you're searching the sender's source, the sender's mailbox as a source, right? You can see who that person, who that sender BCC'd on a particular item. Now, if you're not searching that sender, and you're just searching the recipient of the person who was on the BCC line. Right, right. There's you'd be inferring who sent it to them based on who the sender was to an item that they have in their mailbox. Yeah, please, Quentin Christensen. Well, you can introduce yourself, right?
Yeah. So I'm Quentin. I work on the eDiscovery team at Microsoft. We have recently released. We're in the process of releasing an update in Office 365 where if you have a mailbox on hold, we expand the distribution list and we record all the BCC recipients. So that will now be covered. And there's two ways you can approach that because it's only when the mailbox are on hold. So you could have a broad policy across your organization to just keep everybody on hold for 30 days, right? You can put in a time-based hold policy and you can do a search, yeah. So that's something that is coming. That will go, I'm not sure what our timeline is for the on-prem update of that. We may release that in a service, in a future cumulative update or service pack, or it'll definitely come out with the next exchange release.
Yeah, so that's been something that, just as an aside, right, the information protection team at Microsoft, right, has reorganized to focus on e-discovery and compliance concerns across Microsoft tools, right, and they've really doubled down on their investment there. They want to make it even better, right? So they delivered what we needed to be able to start saving, $3.7 million internally a year. But there's even more that they can do, and they're really committed to doing that. And really, their ambition has just been staggering from my perspective, right? To see how fast they've ramped up and what they've been able to deliver in such a short amount of time and see what their ambitions are for the future. It's just, they're just making my life easier, right? And so instead of being bent over my computer, right.
So to know that that's in the next release, that's within our time frame, and I'm excited about that.
Great. Yeah. They keep making it better. They keep, Quentin talks to a customer at least one a day about e-discovery needs and what would they need to be able to, to manage their e-discovery and compliance concerns natively without having to have offline tools or third-party technology. What can we build in at the source, right? So it's going to keep growing quickly. Right. So yes, you can. The question is how can you detect the content that might not be fully indexed in place, right? If an item has an image, if it's a TIFF file or if it's a JPEG that might contain text, and to a human, right, to a lawyer who's looking at the document, they'd say, well, that should be responsive. It says right here in this part of the document, the keywords I'm looking for. The lawyer's not going to care that it wasn't easy for the search indexer to determine whether or not it was responsive because it didn't OCR it, right? The document says what the document says, and the lawyer needs to search it. So we're not OCRing content right now, but we're flagging the items that have unsearchable content as unsearchable, and then when you go to export the content, you can include the unsearchable items, and it's going to download them in a segregated subfolder, so you have your known hits in these folders, and then you have your unknown hits in these other folders. And that's actually part of our process at Microsoft, is we always include the index errors and we always remediate those so that we're searching what we're initially blind to as part of creating, a reasonable approach to e-discovery, so that we're just taking care of what's, we're going that extra mile to make sure that we're doing comprehensive searches. There's also the ability, if you want to do that before you actually run your search for responsiveness, you can go in here on the Sources tab. I'm not going to back out of this screen right now, but I'll show you shortly, and just run an error-only export, you can choose what sources you want to download just the index errors from, and then you'll have an offline copy, and you can either give those to your Lit support vendor and say, can you run these searches against this subset? I can't search it myself. Or you can maybe you have a native tool, or maybe you're just going to download them, check the error log, figure out what went wrong with them, remediate certain things, right? Maybe it's just is encrypted and needs to be decrypted, and you can decrypt it and throw it up on a file share, another SharePoint site, and let it be re-indexed. You have another question?
What would be the challenge? We have the Office 365 SharePoint, and we have a mixed implementation, so the mailbox is still on-premise, and Link and all the other repositories. I mean, how do you bring them in when we are on Office 365 mm-hmm. and the rest of the infrastructure is not?
So the question is, how do you reach everything when everything is not in the same environment? You might have some content in Exchange Online and SharePoint Online, and you might have some content in Exchange On-Prem and SharePoint On-Prem and On-Prem file shares, right? And so that's how we are as well, right? We've got content in a lot of different locations, right? We've got all sorts of dog food forests. We've got all sorts of old forests that are on old versions of tools that we just still need to support because our customers are still on them. I've got multiple e-discovery centers, right? And when I have content that's in some location that I can't get from this one, well, I'll just need to go to the other e-discovery center and add those sources for this case in a separate SharePoint e-discovery site that I have in that forest, right? Under that separate e-discovery center, and search the sources that I can reach there. Does that make sense? So your entire SharePoint...
No, that would be like the plans. It's now, some of them are there, but
okay.
You want to move them all.
So you want to move all of your SharePoint online, but you don't want to, and you don't want to have any SharePoint on-prem, but you want to keep Exchange on-prem?
Well, they are still there, and so with the file shares and other repositories.
Right. So what...
Databases and...
SharePoint Online can't search SharePoint on-prem content. It's not going to index from the cloud to on-prem. You'd have to have a small footprint of SharePoint 2013 on-prem there to index what you have that you haven't migrated yet. It's actually how we've done it as well, right? Ultimately, at Microsoft, we want to get everything online, but right now we're very much in a hybrid state, and I've got to have SharePoint in both locations so that I can go and search content online, and search on-prem content on-prem. Yes? So link, the question is, when I choose link message types as a filter here, where is it finding it? Because I didn't add any link sources as sources to my search scope. Link content is written into, right, assuming you have the connection between your Exchange servers and your link servers, the link conversation history will be ported to Exchange. If you've got a mailbox where it's not on hold, but your end user's local link clients are set to archive instant message content, it's getting saved as each conversation would be a message in a conversation history folder in Exchange mailbox that the end user has access to. But the data there is indexed just like any other Exchange item.
Do you have to have archiving turned on?
So if you don't have archiving turned on, that's option B. But you do have in-place hold enabled on the mailbox, and you've got the right connection between your link server and your Exchange server, it's going to automatically port the IM content and any meeting content into the recoverable items partition of the mailbox. So the end user is not going to know the IM content is being saved, but it's going to be saved there and discoverable and searchable and protected alongside all the other Exchange content. So by searching Garth's mailbox, I'm searching, and because Garth's mailbox is in place hold enabled, I'm also searching any IM content that Garth has had that's transpired since I enabled in place hold, or whatever he would have saved, whatever he archived in the conversation history folder before I enabled in place hold. So just want to jump back to the export experience here really quickly. Like Exchange, I can do SharePoint-specific filters, right? Let's say I care only to include my web pages, my spreadsheets, and my docs, but I want to filter out the OneNotes or PowerPoints, or I know from my 25 SharePoint results that it's one of these item types. If there are other file types represented by my search results, I'd have other file filters here, right? So it allows you to do deep filtering there, and you can filter on other SharePoint-specific metadata properties like author, content class, and so forth. And again, you can, you know, click in, get a read-only rendering of these items. You can hover over them and see some high-level metadata about it, and you can click in and see what it actually would be. But we've culled our, you know, 1,300 items down to the 24 that we actually want to get our attorneys. And I can, you know, just hit save on this query and come back to it after telling them there would be 24 if this is what you asked us to look for. Or if he says, he or she says, you know, just get me the data as quickly as possible. All I do is hit export, and I'm moments away from having a copy of that content offline. It gives me the flexibility to deduplicate exchange content. By default, it's going to download a PST per mailbox searched and just download the responsive items with the folder structure intact in the PSTs. But if I click this and deduplicate the exchange content, I'll just get one single flattened PST that'll have only a unique copy of each of the unique items that our custodians have in their sources downloaded into that PST. So it's a great way of being able to further minimize what you're exporting. Quentin, I heard you say that it's an average of 50% of a further reduction when you're using deduplication. Every export comes along with an EDRM XML manifest file, and it logs each and every item downloaded so that you can, and it logs the original folder path associated with each of those, so you'd actually be able to reduplicate offline using that load file if you wanted to, so that you'd be able to just download one copy that was of an item that was in Garth's inbox and Katie's, you know, sent items and Sarah's deleted items, and you'd be able to retell that story offline from that load file if you want. Did you have a question? So the question is there the ability to deduplicate export sets against each other? And I wish there were, and Quentin knows how much I wish there was. So it's something that we want and we need, and it's been prioritized accordingly, right? All right. So if versioning was turned on any of my SharePoint sources, if I check this button to include versions, it would download the interim versions that were saved as well. And then here's the option to include items that are encrypted or have an unrecognized format. These are my index errors that we were talking about earlier, right? And so checking this button would do what you wanted, right, to download the items that may be responsive if you could only search the entirety of them, right? So for purposes of this export, I'll just leave it blank just so that we can finish this quickly. But that's something that I do all the time in production. Every time I'm doing an export, I'm always checking that so that I'm making sure that I'm searching what I'm blind to. Yes. Yes. So it's going to ask me to sign in one time here. And then it's going to launch my eDiscovery download manager, and it's a local client that's going to go out and pull the content down and write it to wherever I have permissions to write to. So I've got this set to write it onto a folder on my desktop, but you know, if I want to write it to a network share, or if I want to write it to an external hard drive that I could then just unplug and hand off, I could do that. It tells me how much space I need and how much space I have available, so I can make sure that there's enough capacity to fit what I've got to download, because usually I'm downloading a lot more than just, you know, 28 megs. So it asked me to sign in one last time and authenticate that I really do have permissions to do what I'm going to do. And then it's going to start the download. And it's going to download from all those sources you know, at once and give me all the content offline that I need. And it looks like Windows Explorer is a little tired of me right now and stopped responding. But it's just creating a folder on my desktop and creating a quick set of lists of the items that it needs to download, and then once the lists have been created and finalized, then it's going to go and download the actual items themselves. Let's see if... Yeah. I've got another export that I did a while back so we can look at here while this finishes. It gives me a list of what happened, right? An export summary, and it logs from a chain of custody perspective. It tells the story of what we just did, right? It tells me what the case was called and what the URL was where I did all my searches and what I called my export. And did I deduplicate, or did I include versions, or did I include the uncallable content, right? It memorializes my options there, and it tells me how many items it thought it was going to download versus how many items it actually downloaded. You see this one got more, and it's because I included the uncrawlable content then. It says who I was logged in as when I ran the client, and when I started, when I finished it. It took 2 minutes to get this offline. It tells me there are a couple container errors, so I'll know I want to check a couple logs to see what was missed. But of course, because I included the uncrawlable content, I'm covered, right? Because I already have an offline copy of what I couldn't search natively downloaded. But it also lists the sources that I searched, right? All my mailboxes and all the SharePoint locations, right? It gives me the full path, and it gives me the friendly name. And then it lists the queries that were run against them, right? And I had more keywords there, but it lists my, you know, the keyword query, where we spent most of the time on building those filters. And then it also has my preservation query, which is all this that I used. Plus, it memorializes the item type filter, or the item filters that I applied, right? For exchange sources, I limited it to emails and IMs, right? And so it's logging that. And so when I hand this off to my attorneys, they know how did this data set come to be? Who did it? When did they do it? What did they get? What did they search for? So it's all documented here for you automatically. It's also auditable if you are tracking these types of activities at the source, but it's automatically downloaded for you. And then you have that manifest file that I told you about that can be used as a load file for getting the data into a linear review tool, right? So if you want to import to a tool like Clearwell that can use, it can load from EDRM XML sources, it can use this as a load file and just repopulate the review database with all the data that you just downloaded. And it will allow you to reduplicate if you need to. Then, of course, it gave me the data, and because I didn't deduplicate, it gave me a PST per mailbox. And the sales and marketing site collection content is organized as it was on the server, but it's kind of an offline explorer view, right? And the pages themselves come out as MHT files, so what I'm handing off to my attorneys are, you know, offline compilations of the HTML code of the page themselves, right? So they can see, they get the full SharePoint experience without having to have the network access. They're seeing it as the end users would see it without having the network requirement. And the documents get downloaded, of course, as native files, foldered as they were natively. So just 2 minutes passed. I know you guys are itching to get to the NASCAR. Thanks for sticking around. I know it's late. If you do have any other questions, feel free to ask them or come check in. I'll be at the compliance booth tomorrow at noon. But this has been something that's really given me a much better work-life balance, and it's helping Microsoft to save a ton of money, and it's helping our attorneys to defend us better because we can get them the data so quickly, and they can orient themselves in the case so much more quickly than they ever were in the past.